got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Cameron and Kevin back again. Kevin, what's going on down there in Florida?
COVID-19 spreading like wildfire. Nothing exciting. It's like one out of every so many people now is presumed to be active. So I'm hiding.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. I don't know if you heard about it, but there's this big mega church out here in Northern California that has just said it's not going to close. Despite the governor's order to reinstate the lockdowns. So their first meeting post new lockdown is this Sunday. So I'm interested to see how that all goes down. So we'll see.
Well, they may have the secret force field around it that might, I guess they're doing the experiment, right?
Yeah. Well, not to sound cold and removed, but yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. So we'll see what happens, but, let's jump into some other non-COVID stories for today. So first up, a bogus treatment that is supposed to improve erectile function was published in a mainstream science journal. So we're going to talk about how that happened and what that might mean about the peer review process. And then Europe's Green Party has defended its stance opposing genetic engineering in food and agriculture, but it is also saying that using those technologies in medicine is perfectly fine. Sounds like a double standard to me. So we'll dig into that as well. And then finally, pesticide fears are pushing wine growers to embrace new breeding techniques like CRISPR. So we're going to talk about that. That's going to be a fascinating development. But Kevin, first up, I think this is the most interesting thing we're going to talk about. So a homeopathic remedy or a treatment to improve erectile function got into this journal. So what's going on?
Yeah, this is a really interesting example of how the peer review process can sometimes fail us. And it comes from the International Journal of Impotence Research, which is not on my coffee table. when you look at what this thing is or what it might be, the article talked about some new kind of compound, and it was called, I'm trying to remember the name of it here, but it was a compound called Impaza. And there was an article published in 2003 that tested for, and it was really kind of ambiguous. They were testing for erectile enhancement in rats. And so, you know, you can ask the easy question, like, what does erectile enhancement mean? And how do you measure it? And how do you turn on a rat? You know, do you whisper in his little ear that, you know, see you running on the wheel, you know? You know, I mean, like, worst graduate career ever, right? So it turns out that this paper was published, and it talks about this stuff called Impaza, which is apparently a monoclonal antibody from what they describe. And it turns out that, I guess we can kind of, let's go to the next part here, is that years later, so 2020, you know, slash cut to 2020, there's four papers that have cited this original work. So nobody really cares about it. It's in the International Journal of Impotence Research, which is a very low impact journal. And the editor raised some questions based upon some questions that were raised by apparently readers of the work. And it was that when you do the math and follow the materials and methods as they describe it, the actual Impaza reagent is so dilute that the molecules that are alleged to be active cannot even be present. So it totally smacked of homeopathy. And although the authors only briefly mentioned homeopathy, they said it was made by homeopathic technology. None of the reviewers caught that. And so that was how this originally got published.
Okay. So a couple of things jump out to me right off the bat. So the first is that what is homeopathy or homeopathic medicine? Just in case someone isn't familiar with that term. And then let's talk about the peer review situation. But go ahead with that first.
Yeah, it gets more ambiguous because a lot of things these days are calling themselves homeopathic because it's kind of a beacon to a certain set of consumers out there. But homeopathy in its purest form was devised by a German back in the late 1800s, I think it was, where you would take a compound that you may be, like they would say, like cures like, right? So if you were having an allergy to dogs, you'd put some dog fur in some water, you would shake it real hard, and you would beat it against a certain kind of leather mitt, and then dilute that, 1 milliliter of that, into 100 of water. And then you would repeat that dilution process sometimes 50 or 100 times. And the idea was not that the original entity was there, but that the energy within it was somehow imparted and stored in the water because of that leather smacking event. And the argument was the more dilute you made it, the stronger it got, which would say that the ocean must be the strongest, most powerful milieu of medicine in the world, right? So homeopathy has long been debunked. It's a bunch of garbage. There's no active ingredients in a homeopathic remedy. And so homeopathic pills are just sugar pills. Homeopathic liquids are just, are just liquids. Sometimes they sneak in a little bit of zinc or something to claim that it's, that it's homeopathic, but there's a possibility it could have some sort of effect. But bottom line is all of these things, when tested rigorously, show no evidence of a clinical effect.
So discovered and they published this article we're talking about, but they said that the peer reviewers more or less rubber stamped this article. So my question to you as a guy that's published all kinds of studies is how common is rubber stamping during peer review? And, do you think people could use this to say, hey, if you're going to let this kind of junk get into your journals, then why should I trust what you say about anything? Like, why should I trust what you say about COVID, for example?
That's a really good point. And it does stress one of the drawbacks of the peer review process. It is the gold standard. But in a low impact journal, it's very hard to find reviewers these days. I mean, I get asked 5 times a day to review a paper. It's hard to find qualified reviewers. And if you're an editor for a journal, you try to find somebody to review the work. Most people who are in this field and really the top of the game, they're not going to mess with an article from a very low impact journal from an unknown group that is pushing and some sort of a novel therapy in rats. It's just not an attractive thing to want to review. So they end up finding 2 people who are willing to do it, who may be, not the best scientists in the world, or whatever they find. And that's sometimes how this can get by without rigorous review. But that's why it's a low impact journal. So you sometimes can have things that escape rigorous peer review. The real test is how much is it repeated by other labs? And how much do they expand on this technique? Like, if it works in rats, well, what does it do in people? Now, those kind of data never come out.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always thought about a peer-reviewed study as the start of a conversation. I think the media especially has trained people who read science to think of a peer-reviewed study. It's like this gospel that kind of comes down from the heavens. And in reality, unless it's like a major groundbreaking study that's been confirmed multiple times, or it's a giant meta-analysis or something, people need to put on their skeptic hat and go, okay, well, here's one study. What other research has been done? And what else do we know about this topic? What are your thoughts, Kevin?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the scientific literature is a conversation where new pieces of data are integrated or tested against the models, and they either expand the models or they don't fit. And a lot of times when they don't fit or they're game changers, it means we underthought the problem. But sometimes there's information that comes to the fore that is just outright bogus. And we're seeing it more and more, especially as a number of countries come online where they incentivize publication, where financially, where if you publish a paper in a good journal, you may get a substantial raise. And that's an incentive for people to publish stuff that has not oftentimes turned out to be reproducible. That may be the case with this one as well, but this one seems to have other conflicts of interest as well, in that five of the authors who are on the original paper are part of the company that makes the drug. And so when you look at the use of this drug in other contexts, other papers, it's all the same players. And so it's a very suspicious series of publications around this drug, which is present in amounts that are so small, it can't possibly be doing anything.
Yeah. And, you know, now that I think about it, this is a good example. This story is a good example of the point we were just talking about, which is this was caught, as you said, by somebody post-publication. I think it was a scientist who makes a point to go and find silly articles like this and tell the journals about them. But nonetheless, it stresses that, you know, even if it's peer-reviewed, even if it shows up in a journal, no matter what impact factor, hey, look out, because, you know, even scientists who review stuff are human and they make mistakes.
Well, sure. And the other big problem is predatory journals, where you have journals that will actively solicit research from less than credible laboratories, and they will publish that work and give them the patina of authenticity and rigorous review, where really they weren't even reviewed. And they have a lot more pay-to-publish opportunities. You pay the $700 fee, and the work may be reviewed by an editor and then is published. And this is another thing that really detracts from the credibility of the peer review process and how much trust people place in those findings.
Yep, very important point. So just remember, yeah, whatever you're reading, even if it's from an ostensibly reliable source, just think through it, make sure that it's accurate information. But Kevin, let's talk about the Green Party in Europe and what seems to me like a clear double standard. So tell us about this article.
Well, this is kind of a neat one. This is from Natasha Foote of Your Active, EUR, like Europe Active, July 8th of this year. And she talked about the German Green Party in EU. They wrote a white paper that indicated the potential utility of genetic engineering in European crops. Now, this goes back to the notion that gene editing, this newest technology, which provides very limited change to DNA, typically targeting a gene, this is the future, and this is the way things are going. And we've talked about it in medicine, cures sickle cell anemia. You know, we've talked about this in previous weeks. But the German Green Party says, okay, you know, this is banned, but there might be some room for this to work here. And for what it's worth, German scientists are really ticked off that this is a non-available technology, because, you know, this is good stuff. This is politics ruling over science. And so there are people inside the Green Party who read this white paper and said, hold on a minute. nothing to it here. We're not interested. You know, this is just one little opinion, and we are not interested in the way that in doing anything to add GMOs.
Right. It's almost like when you're a parent and you're in public and your kid says something you don't like, and you're like, just kidding. He didn't mean that. He doesn't know what he's saying. I kind of got that vibe.
Yeah.
From the situation. So what it tells me, or at least what I think it shows, is that there's a younger generation of environmentalists, you know, the millennials and Generation Z, and these people aren't as risk averse when it comes to technology. And so they see some of the benefits that we talk about on the show, and they go, you know, we really should make use of this. So maybe that's an encouraging sign, even though they got overruled by, I suppose, the party leadership. The fact that you're starting to see cracks in the edifice is a good sign.
Yeah, the crabby old hippie shut them down, right? You know, this is the really funny part about this is that they still have this attachment to precautionary principle that they say, you know, that we have to take every precaution to make sure no harm ever is done. Yet, in the same article, they talk about things like mutation breeding. So, just to contrast, CRISPR and gene editing are small number of changes in a specific gene and maybe some other collateral effects that you can measure, versus mutation breeding, which is bombarding a genome with radiation or chemistry, creating possibly tens of thousands of changes that nobody understands and no one knows where they are, but that is considered okay. You know, it's the old Frankenfood paradox in action again. And, you know, they say the same people who are the critics said, quote, well, mutation breeding has been under observation a long time, and it's therefore considered safer because we've had time to see adverse effects. So, you know, it's the old fallacy of, well, we never saw anything wrong with it, so we therefore it's safe. And and the other technology, well, too young, so we can't really say that.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. That's sort of a silly argument to me, because I think, and Kevin, you know more about this, but I think the first gene editing tool came out in like the mid-90s. It was it zinc finger nucleases or talons, or it was one of those that was first sort of developed, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. There were zinc finger nucleases and something called meganucleases, but just ways of specifically digesting away specific genes. Pretty cool stuff.
Okay, so in other words, we're going on 30 years now of testing and utilizing this technology to develop new crop varieties. And so that argument just isn't going to hold up for very long, I don't think. You know what I mean? So is it another 10 years and then gene editing is okay? I just get the sense that when that time comes, they're going to go, well, you know, they're going to fall back on the unnatural thing, or you know what I mean? They're not going to go, okay, well, a sufficient amount of time has passed and now we accept this. I just don't see that happening.
Well, the funny part is that the more they dig in their heels on it now, the later that's going to be. And, you know, the thing that's really sad about this is that I kind of dig the Green Party platform. I'm all for environmental concerns. I love their positions on climate. I love the way they think about mitigating impacts of different industries. I'm on board. But then they take this very strong anti-science stance against genetic engineering. And the problem there is that it destroys the credibility of all the good things that they want to do. And, you know, if they could come out and say, you know what, we can live with this technology. This is fantastic. You know, but the problem is they have such a strong core, such a strong contingency that sees gene editing as just a way for Monsanto, Bayer, Dow, whatever, to stuff their pockets with money, that they can't let it happen.
And it's funny you say that, because the arguments that this faction was making, they could have come from you or me, or they could have even come from Bayer or Syngenta, you know, because they're saying this is no different than mutation breeding. You already use this technology in a variety of ways in medicine, in vaccines, for example. And so those are the kind of arguments that again, as I said, you or me would make, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's amusing to me that they're starting to, the logic of these supposedly evil actors, they're like, hey, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, and that's what's going on is I do think that there's a lot of fatigue around the naysayers, and that their messages are old, that, you know, those of us who've been discussing the sciences and its strengths and its weakness for now, you know, 30 years, it really is to the point where it starts to take away from their credibility, and people are just sick of hearing about it. You know, all of the doom and gloom scenarios they predicted back in 1990, 95, 2000, none have come true. And it just continues to take away from the credibility of a movement that around climate says we need to follow the scientists. And it's, you can't pick and choose which science you want to follow. You know, let's get on board and follow all of it and what do what science says is best. That's the way we can be truly green.
And just to put a cherry on top of this, just 2 days after the Green Party put this out, the European Union suspended some of its regulations on the use of GMOs in research to help develop a COVID vaccine. And as we've talked about on this show, some of the vaccines are being developed using genetically engineered plants. And so the European Union said, well, you know, it makes sense. We have to do this. And I commend them for that, but it's still nonetheless very amusing that all of a sudden the concerns about crops escaping into the wild and gene flow and all that, those don't matter as much. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's really true. And really it extends into the next story that there will come a time when heads will explode because they realize that the technology they have banned is really what's best.
Yeah. Just got the image of somebody's head exploding. So, speaking of the next story, so fears of pesticide use are encouraging people to turn to some of these technologies. So tell us about this.
Yeah, this was written by Ritoban Mukherjee in Mental Floss. And it follows up on a number of different stories that have been written over the last several years about wine grapes. And why this is really important is because wine grapes come from vines that have, some go back thousands and thousands of years. And on my podcast a long time ago, we talked about the difference between wine snobs and beer snobs. You know, beer snobs are always seeking something new and unusual, some crazy kinds of hops or different flavorings or different stuff that you can put in your beer, whatever. You know, more diversity is better. But wine aficionados want very little deviation from a standard. You want Cabernet Sauvignon, you want Merlot, you want, you know, whatever it is, you have a specific thing you want that they put in that bottle. And what that means is that these very old heritage varieties, these tremendous monocultures of old heritage varieties, are relatively weak and have trouble surviving threats such as fungus and insects. And so they come up with ways to solve those problems. They're very pesticide intensive. Even organic farming uses Bordeaux mixture, which is lime and copper sulfate. There's massive amounts of the stuff that are used. If you go by an organic grape operation at the right time of year, you'll see it covered in sulfur, just these beautiful golden fields covered in sulfur, pounds and pounds per acre. So between the pesticide application and then the management of vines, you know, trimming them so that you have enough airflow through the vines, it's really intensive. And it's expensive, it's intensive, and it requires a lot of management. So, you know, you think you'd need new grape varieties, right? But when breeders make new grape varieties, the public doesn't want them. They want the, you know, Cabernet, the, you know, the, I don't know wine very well. So just the ones that they have, you know, they're the ones they recognize, you know.
It's pronounced Merlot, Kevin.
Yes. Down here in Florida, we have me a glass of Merlot.
Tell you what.
But basically all of these, the only wine I've ever had is Mad Dog 2020. And that's been a while. It hasn't been since college. Long story short, but I can't drink the stuff because of the sulfites. You know, Mr. Iron Gut McGinty can't drink wine. But the bottom line is that people reject the new stuff and they specifically shop from wines made by the grape types they recognize. And so it really puts us in a perfect storm for threats to grapes or heavy investment and intensive use of pesticides to be able to grow those grapes.
What's so cool to me is that it's the industry itself that has recognized the benefits of gene editing in this case, because what they realized is that they can just edit the genome of whatever grape is in question and they can still call it a Merlot or whatever, because it is technically, you've just corrected the mistake that allows it to get infected. And so, you know, and as we've talked about on the show, you know, a lot of industries and, you know, food manufacturers, they do everything they can to get away from biotechnology because it's so toxic to their consumer base. Like with orange juice, for example, we've talked about that. But they're saying, oh, no, this makes perfect sense. And we can benefit from this. So I just thought that was an interesting contrast to have this one industry go, oh, well, this is going to help us preserve our business model.
Well, this is the point, is that they can maintain the promise of the integrity of the genetics. They basically say, this is still Merlot. This is still Cabernet Sauvignon. This is still, give me another one. I don't know, Pinot Noir. How about that?
Oh, beautiful.
Pinot Noir. And you can say that you still have the genetic integrity as it relates to the grape itself. The difference is the susceptibility genes. So a number of fungi and these things like downy mildew, powdery mildew, they infect plants based on a mechanism where they basically shake hands with the with the plant itself in a molecular way that allows the fungus to become pathogenic. And so there are proteins produced that are recognized by the pathogen that are the first steps in infection. So if you can gene edit out those effector molecules, if you can gene edit those and basically take away the lock for the fungus's key, you now don't allow that infection to take place. And so scientists know the genes that are responsible for this, and you can go into a fungal genome and edit those genes. There's a few, handful of these things, but even the major one, you knock the major one out, you get good resistance. You can edit these genes and confer resistance without changing the grape itself. And this is why that technology is so cool and so welcome to the grape industries that want to keep the genetics the same.
And maybe this is more of a meta point, if you will, but I think this underscores just how hugely important marketing and messaging is when you're talking about this stuff, because, it appears the facts really don't matter. So even if you can make a better grape that tastes great and it's better for the environment, if it's called something different than people recognize, then they just go, well, I'm not going to buy it. I'm just going to buy what I want because that's what I want because my brain tells me so. You know what I mean? So that's just something probably important for people like you and me to keep in mind, is the way we talk about this really matters.
Oh, it really does. And what's really interesting about wine is that there's even some other levels to this, because the genetic engineering isn't just done on the grapevine, right? It's also done on the yeast itself. And so there's ways that yeast have been genetically engineered using gene editing, using CRISPR-Cas9, to change the way that they produce compounds like resveratrol. And resveratrol is this compound which is allegedly has some health effects in vitro, potentially in vivo. And it's produced in small amounts. So to get a clinically effective amount, you'd have to drink something like 55 liters of wine. I mean, when you do, so it's not a real, necessarily been shown to be that good in a practical sense. But, it doesn't hurt, right? And in the Petri dish, it shows that there is some effect. So you can find ways to use CRISPR-Cas9 to boost resveratrol and also limit the production of compounds that lead to hangovers. So some of the stuff that breaks down into the aldehydes that cause that feeling. So there are other ways in which gene editing touches on wine itself.
Yeah, it's very cool stuff. And I mean, just another example of the many we've talked about where this is really making a big difference in food production. And just on the way out the door, I got to tell you that I've been wine tasting with my in-laws, and I'm right where you are, Kevin. I have no idea what I'm drinking or what I'm talking about. The only upside is that, you get a little bit of a buzz as you're tasting all these kind of gross wines. And so I tried to fool my father-in-law the last time we went. I was like, oh, this one has more of an earthy overtone. And he's like, you don't know what the hell you're drinking, do you? I was like, no. He's like, okay. Well, and it was fun.
But they've done those studies. They've put price tags on bottles of wine that were all the same wine and put different price tags on them and asked people how they would rank them. And they rank them with the price. And a couple of years ago, I got schooled in wine by none other than Dr. Fred Perlack. Dr. Fred Perlack was the scientist that came up with the first BT cotton. And we sat in his house and he opened a $5 bottle of wine, a $50 bottle of wine, and like a $500 bottle of wine from the cellar. And, he was very gracious in helping me understand how they all tasted different. And, but to me, maybe I could taste a little difference here and there, but I couldn't justify spending $495, on difference on that. And, and I felt really like I only drank a little sip of it, and then I had him drink the rest because that's a little rich for my blood.
Yep, it's Jack and Coke for me. That's the about as refined as I get. But speaking of cool stuff that people can do on the weekend, Kevin, what's up with Talking Biotech?
Well, the last Talking Biotech was a really interesting interview with Dr. Ava Faré from Michigan State University about molecular clocks. How do circadian clocks work, and how do cells in plants and animals keep time? And it was a really fascinating discussion where we just scratched the surface of a really interesting topic. So that's a good one to tune into.
Yes, as always, check it out. And if you want to interact with us, we are on Twitter, at Kevin Folta, at Cam J English. So hit us up, let us know what you think of these episodes. And you can also get us on Spotify and iTunes and geneticliteracyproject.org. And we will see you next week.